Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I would like now to welcome Arjun Makhijani. He is a PhD in nuclear engineering and the author of Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, a Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. And he will be giving a talk on Thursday, September 18th from 6 to 8 at the University of New Mexico Law School, room 2401. It's titled Carbon Free and Nuclear Free Roadmap. And for more information, you can call the New Mexico Environmental Law Center at 989-9022. They're one of the sponsors of this. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me.
In your book, you write about the importance of achieving zero carbon dioxide emissions in order to minimize the harm related to climate change. First of all, what kind of harm are we looking at if we continue business as usual, burning coal and petroleum and gas?
Well, there's, you know, we've long had harm even before climate change with cities that are very polluted and asthma and particles and respiratory disease and so on. But climate change is on top of all that. For instance, if we have severe climate change, we have what is known as sea level rise, and then we will lose a lot of the coastal areas. This isn't just about Bangladesh becoming flooded, but though it will. It's about altering the map of Florida, for instance. It's about forgetting about all those areas along the Gulf Coast that we've been reading about that are only temporarily underwater now that would be permanently underwater. So literally the landscape would be transformed. Secondly, we're looking at different patterns of disease, different patterns of rainfall. So for instance, droughts and floods will become intensified. A lot of areas that now grow food will no longer be able to grow food. Or at least as plentifully. We're talking about forests dying away. For instance, even now as we speak, in Alaska, millions of acres have been affected with a pest, a beetle, that normally died off in the winter and therefore the pest was under control. But now the warm season is much longer and it's much hotter and there are millions of acres of forest that are dying. And once we start a cycle like that, we have no idea where it'll wind up. Actually, you know, the people who say climate models are wrong are quite right. They are wrong, but not in the way they think. It's happening much faster and much worse than we thought.
You write about the link between nuclear power and the danger of nuclear weapons proliferation because of the connection between nuclear power and nuclear weapons technologies and infrastructures. If this were somehow to be managed, would nuclear power be a potential green technology, as our presidential candidates seem to be claiming?
Well, the problem is that it can't be managed. This problem has been known since the Manhattan Project and Oppenheimer, who was actually out there in New Mexico in Los Alamos, in 1946, when he wrote about a potential nuclear weapons convention, which would ban nuclear weapons, this is a paraphrase now, he said that the United States would build plants and call them power plants, and they would may or may not produce power, but they would be designed in such a way that they could be converted with a maximum ease and speed to producing nuclear weapons. The human infrastructure, the materials, the technologies have a huge overlap. So once we're worried about one enrichment plant, for instance, in Iran that takes natural uranium and makes it more usable for bombs. Now, exactly the same factory can be used to make materials that can make a nuclear weapon like the one that destroys Hiroshima. Now, so you need those kinds of factories and that kind of infrastructure for nuclear power, and then you can use the same for nuclear weapons at the same time. Now, we're worried about one uranium enrichment plant in Iran. Now, if we use nuclear power to try to solve the problem of climate change, for instance, by replacing coal-fired power plants with nuclear power plants, we'd have to build one nuclear power plant a week for 40 years, and then we'd need two or three enrichment plants every single year somewhere in the world. James Lovelock, whom I admire greatly, but I don't think he's really done very much studying about energy. He invented the Gaia hypothesis, you know, that the Earth is like a living creature.
Right.
He has said, well, you know, renewable energy sources are small, and nuclear is the only answer to this disease, and we should do like the French, who get 80% of their power from nuclear. Now, the French do get nearly 80% of the power from nuclear. If we do like the French, we'll have to build two nuclear reactors, more than two nuclear reactors a week somewhere in the world. They become targets for terrorism. They're potential for catastrophic accidents. Now, we're told that we can't have an accident here like Chernobyl, which devastated a huge area, which is still off limits more than two decades after the accident. Now, it's technically true that U.S. reactors can't have the same kind of accident as Chernobyl because Chernobyl had a lot of graphite in it that caught fire. But can U.S. reactors have radioactivity releases on the same scale as Chernobyl, which is really what we're talking about? Can it devastate a huge area? The answer to that is yes. The probability is lower. It's not as likely to happen. They're better designed and I think better inspected and better run, although I'm not a fan of our Nuclear Regulatory Commission here. But they are possible. And if we build more and more reactors, of course, we get more and more targets and higher likelihood of accidents. So there you have it.
What fossil fuels are currently responsible for what percentage of carbon dioxide emissions? In other words, what are the biggest culprits? Is it coal, or is it all sort of divided equally?
Well, from the electricity sector, it's mainly coal. That's what we mainly use coal for. So almost all the coal that is produced here and most of it in China and India and Russia and Germany, a few other countries, is used for electricity production. In transportation, it's oil, you know, obviously. And in industry, it is a mixture of oil, coal, and natural gas. Of the fossil fuels, natural gas has done less damage than the others. Coal and oil are about more or less the same.
So before we talk about the potential for zero carbon dioxide emissions power sources, let's talk about the mechanisms that would give current energy producers who are producing fossil fuel energy in one way or another financial and legal incentives to make that transition.
Well, currently, you know, if you damage your neighbor's house, or if you damage your neighbor's lawn, or if you pollute your neighbor's stream, it's expected that you might make reparations. Currently, by emitting carbon dioxide, and it's true of all of us, but certainly true of the big companies more, we are polluting the earth, and we're currently, climate change is going on. This is no longer hypothetical. This is happening. It's not this hurricane or that hurricane that we can say that's caused by the increase of greenhouse gases, but overall there are now significant effects that are very likely caused by all these greenhouse gases. The main problem is that we allow the use of fossil fuels that emit carbon dioxide without a penalty and without a deadline to get rid of them. We had the same problem with ozone depleting chemicals. There was no deadline to get rid of them. Anybody could go out and buy Freon and put it in their air conditioner or car air conditioner, for instance, and then it got emitted and we had an ozone depletion problem. We have to put a price on carbon, and we have to put a deadline to get rid of it. And that's why I say carbon-free. We have to say by the middle of the century, we're going to have an economy that is completely free of fossil fuels, and every year we're going to get rid of 2% or 2.5% or whatever.
Are you talking about the developing countries, or are you talking about all countries?
I'm talking about all countries. My book was written about the United States because it is the largest emitter of greenhouse gases. It's about the same as China currently, where China has four times bigger population. So per capita, the United States, we who live here, emit about four times as much. I think the same thing or something close to it needs to be done worldwide. Just let me say, globally, there are other greenhouse gases like methane. There's carbon dioxide that comes from forest burning, from land use changes. So there are, the problem of greenhouse gases is somewhat more complex than fossil fuels. But in the United States, fossil fuels is more than 80% of the problem. And if we get rid of fossil fuels, we'll have gone almost all the way there.
We're talking to Arjun Makhijani, who will be speaking on Thursday, September 18th at 6 o'clock at the University of New Mexico Law School in a conversation titled Carbon-Free and Nuclear-Free Roadmap. So what is the nature of the political opposition and the economic opposition to this happening, the way you're talking about it, capping carbon emissions and requiring reductions each year? Who are the players trying to maintain the extraction and use of fossil fuels until they're entirely gone, and promoting the use of nuclear energy?
Well, as you know Exxon and companies that produce oil and gas have been in the leadership of the opposition. Some companies have said, okay, we can put some curbs on carbon dioxide, but when it comes to the practice of it, they actually oppose serious measures to put a real price on carbon. You know, there was a treaty called the Kyoto Protocol that the United States helped to shape but did not ratify. The Europeans went along, and then the European large corporations, the chemical companies, the electrical companies, they all wanted free allowances. You know, it's like having a free airplane ticket. You're encouraged to fly. Now, they have free allowances to emit carbon dioxide and have something of a target to reduce, and it's been a failure. So mostly it's the companies that produce the fossil fuels. It's the companies that want to sell new nuclear power plants. It's the companies that mine uranium that are opposed to carbon-free and nuclear-free. Now, some companies that make nuclear power plants say, okay, you know, I'm going to come and save you from coal. If you don't like coal, build nuclear power plants. But the main opposition to carbon dioxide comes from large corporations that have vested interests in this. In fairness, I should also say there are a lot of people who are afraid that there would be an economic disruption because energy really is the lifeblood of an industrial economy, and that if we make it very expensive, somehow we will disrupt the economy. And I have to say, when I started researching my book somewhat over 2 years ago, I didn't myself think that it was possible to get rid of all fossil fuels and nuclear power at the same time at reasonable cost. And it was a surprise to me to conclude that we could do it, because there is a technological revolution that is going on. So part of it is people just not being aware and being afraid of the unknown. It's no longer unknown. I've shown that it can be done, and it can be done with reasonable costs. So we should get it done.
How much of this carbon dioxide emission can be reduced purely by conservation as opposed to other non-carbon energy sources? How would this be achieved?
Well, there are two different things that get mixed up into the same word, conservation. There's efficiency, which is, say, having the same air conditioning and having the same kind of transportation, using personal vehicles and flying and so on. And then there is being more thrifty. Now, learning to turn off the lights, perhaps giving up meat, you know, and so on. Giving up the more energy-intensive things, or giving up, say, living far away from home and having 4 acres in the countryside and commuting 30 miles every day. Now, what my book is about is not being more thrifty. I assume that people would go on doing the kinds of things that we do that, you know, despite the fact that sprawl is not very good, people seem to like to live farther and so on, that would all go on, that we would not become more virtuous somehow, as Vice President Cheney put it. This is not about virtue. I assume that we would have the same type of economy and it would keep on growing in the same way. And I ask the question, can we get rid of fossil fuels and nuclear in that framework? And the answer to that was yes. Now, of course, if we become more conscious and learn to switch off the lights and have smart growth and live closer to work, then we can make it happen faster. And we need to.
It is interesting because there's a sort of a cultural divide between, I think, those who think that we should all live differently and those who think that we should just simply use green energy sources, and you're really arguing the latter.
I'm not arguing the latter in the sense that I'm saying that we can, even if you are on that side of the cultural divide, we can do it. What I am saying is that it would be good for us to, you know, it doesn't do anybody any good if there's a light on and there's nobody in the room because nobody's seeing anything in it as a result of that. It doesn't enhance anybody's quality of life. So it is much better, and then it is better if we do live closer to work and don't spend so much time in cars and pollute the cities and pave everything over. But what I'm saying is, even if we ignore that, if we're on the Cheney side of the cultural divide, we can still get it done. I'm not saying that we should be there.
Right.
I'm just saying, if you assume the proportion of people who are virtuous about energy and conscious about their habits will not change, then we can still get it done. I'm not arguing that we should be that way.
Right.
Yeah. I'm just saying we need a set of policies that will get us there. And then I think we also need to become more conscious because climate change is happening very rapidly. And if we care about the kind of world we're going to leave our children, this is not 100 years from now that we're talking about. The worst, let me give you an example of how fast it is. This is happening, and how much is not in the models. Until 2 years ago, the worst case projection for complete melting of Arctic ice in the summer was 70 years from now. Today, the worst case projection is 5 years from now.
Good heavens. Yes,
because last year, two-thirds of the Arctic ice melted away in the summer, and this year looks to be about the same. And when the oceans get hotter, when the Arctic gets hotter in the summer, the whole Earth heats up because the water absorbs solar energy much more efficiently than ice, which reflects most of it. So we will see faster melting of the Greenland ice sheets and faster sea level rise. Now, you know, other than ozone depletion, I have never spoken like this in my life. I am not a catastrophist. I'm an engineer. I kind of tend to look at things rather coolly and in a very measured way. I started talking about serious climate change after the National Academy of Sciences because I don't like to be wrong. So I'm pretty conservative when I make calls on the science. Is everything certainly sure about where we're headed? No, but would you get a transfusion of blood that had been screened for AIDS in a hospital? No. We do not want a 90% chance of disaster. That's not sensible, especially when, with modest effort, we could live much better.
We're talking to Arjun Makhijani. Currently, as you mentioned a little while ago, different energy sources are used in different sectors. Coal is used to generate electricity, petroleum for transportation, natural gas for heating. In the non-carbon-emitting energy scenario that you outline in your book, what would be the breakdown for the new energy sources?
Well, I think we need to use electricity more. One of the things, you know, Alan Greenspan said in his book, and I think this is an exact quote, the Iraq war is largely about oil. Now, we need to get rid of oil from as much of the economy as possible, as rapidly as possible. Fortunately, today, for the first time, and this is one of the examples of technologies that I think there have been big breakthroughs, electric cars and plug-in hybrids are not only possible, they're going to be on the market in a couple of years. So we can actually, instead of having petroleum in the tank, you can have sunshine in the tank. And if you have electric cars, then you can simply plug them in and go. Now, with an electric car that is being made in England today, it's a sports car, it's very fancy. It goes 0 to 60 in 4 seconds, so it performs like a Lamborghini. It's also a lot cheaper than the Lamborghini. Not affordable for you and me. It's $98,000, but a Lamborghini is $250,000. So
right.
This electric car can be plugged in, and if it is plugged into sunshine, into solar cells, it gives 150 miles to the gallon. It can make the energy problem associated with cars mostly go away. So that's why, that's sort of an example of why I'm saying you don't necessarily have to be virtuous. Now, I'm not advocating $98,000 cars. This is a sports car. We don't need to go 0 to 60 in 4 seconds. Electric cars that have comparable performance to today's gasoline cars, but then won't be polluting, will probably be in the market in the next few years. Certainly plug-in hybrids are slated to be in the market in 2 years.
So if you're talking about electric cars, then what would be the non-fossil fuel-burning energy source that produced the electricity?
The biggest sources of renewable energy are wind energy and solar energy. One of the bumper stickers that came out of my book is parking lots are the answer. We have enough area of parking lots and rooftops, mostly commercial rooftops, to be able to supply most of the electricity requirements by putting solar panels on them. Just imagine how nice it would be to park in the shade, in a shaded parking lot when you go shopping or when you go to work, or and be able to plug your car in. And you can collect the water that falls on the solar cells that are shading your parking spot and use it for gray water. So about an area of 100 miles by 100 miles, about 1/8 the size of Nevada in the U.S. Southwest, can generate all of the electricity requirements of the United States. Now, the wind energy potential is also very great. The U.S. has about the same wind energy potential as all of the oil-producing, Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, put together. All of them put together. It's about the same potential just for wind-generated electricity. Now, most of that is, actually, New Mexico is one of the great wind energy potential states, and your governor, Bill Richardson, has made it a point to try to expand wind energy, not just for New Mexico, but also for New Mexico to become an exporter, you know, so sort of like part of a large OPEC of wind, except right here in the United States.
We're talking to Arjun Makhijani. The technology of solar panels is evolving. Currently, panels are quite expensive. They use copper, which is not only costly, but has to be extracted and is a finite resource. Where are we going with that? Are there new technologies that are cheaper and don't involve so much use of copper?
Well, copper is used in electricity, not so much for solar panels. Some is used there for the wiring, but solar panels are actually made of silicon, which is one of the most plentiful materials in the world, because it's really, silicon is in plain sand. Sand is silicon dioxide, and you have to remove the oxygen from silicon dioxide, and that's what solar panels are made of. So solar panels actually are made of very plentiful materials. Copper is used for the electrical wiring because it's a very good conductor, and aluminum is used for transmission lines. Now, actually, if you put solar panels on parking lots and rooftops and over urban roadways, then, and similar spaces like that on the surfaces of buildings, then you're actually reducing the use of copper and aluminum, because you will not need, at least aluminum, because you will not need so many transmission lines. Now, if you have centralized generation of solar and wind, then, of course, we will need more transmission lines. So partly it will depend on how we approach renewable energy. Now, solar will make, if we have thin film solar, there are some approaches to solar photovoltaics that do use exotic materials like indium and cadmium and so on. But I don't think that there is a serious materials problem. I think we need to attend to the materials issues from the beginning by putting in place recycling for materials and not do the way we did with cell phones and computers and compact fluorescent light bulbs that contain mercury, of putting a system of consumption in place, and then we say, oops, you know, we forgot about the back end, what happens when we have to junk it. We can't do things thoughtlessly. I think we need to put the recycling technologies into place. They are available, like the batteries I was talking about, the kind of batteries, they're the same kind of batteries or similar to what's in our computers, laptops, and cell phones, lithium-ion batteries. Now, you can recycle the materials in lithium-ion batteries, but we need to have a system to collect them and get it done so people don't throw them away. That's the problem.
Right. Well, let's talk about energy storage, batteries, and otherwise. As everybody knows, wind and solar energy are not constant. They vary according to the time of day and the weather. And unlike coal burning and nuclear plants, how would you have energy sources, electrical energy, constantly available using solar and wind?
Now, this is a problem that has different answers depending on what stage of the transformation to renewable energy you're at. Currently, we use only about 1% solar and wind. So to go from 1% solar and wind to 10% solar and wind is not a big deal. Denmark has gone to 20%, and they have shown it's possible. The way you do that is you use existing capacity, like capacity of natural gas-fired power plants and hydropower plants, to back up wind and solar. First of all, you coordinate your wind and solar. Sunshine, of course, is by definition in the daytime. The wind often blows at night. So if you properly coordinate your generation, you don't need so much backup capacity. But you can have, failure of wind energy in the evening when the sun is not shining. So you need some backup capacity. Now, fortunately, in the United States, we have overbuilt natural gas-fired power plants in the last 20 years because natural gas was very cheap. People thought this would be a cheap way to generate electricity, and the natural gas prices have quadrupled and quintupled, and most of that capacity is idle. It's idle more than 80% of the time. The last data I've looked at were for 2006. Now, that capacity can be used to firm up wind and solar. So you do that in the first stages. Solar energy can also be built with storage. It's called concentrating solar thermal power. So you store the heat from the sun in molten salt, like potassium iodide. It's sort of like a different version of common salt. You can melt it with the heat of the sun. You focus like a magnifying glass on a tank of molten salt, on a tank of salt, and it melts. And then you have the heat stored at night. Then you can use that heat to convert water into steam and run a steam turbine just like a regular power plant. So Arizona Public Service, for instance, has ordered a solar thermal power plant that will have 6 hours of heat storage, and they'll be able to generate energy well into the evening after sunset. And we can have up to 15, 16 hours of heat storage. Another thing we can do is to store coldness. Now, I think storing coldness is kind of an odd idea, but we do store coldness all the time. That's what your freezer is. That's what your refrigerator is. So now you can go and buy an air conditioner, for instance, from a company called Ice Energy. And by the way, I don't own stocks in any company, so when I say companies' names, I'm not promoting myself. I deliberately don't own stocks, so that I can talk freely about corporation without conflict of interest. There's this company called Ice Energy, among others, that makes an air conditioner that will make ice and also function as a regular air conditioner. It has the same equipment as your central air conditioner. And it makes ice at night so that in the daytime when it's hot, instead of running an air conditioner, you run the cooling system by melting the ice. So you draw the coldness from the ice. In the Netherlands, they have been doing an experiment with making freezers that store food in large frozen food warehouses and cooling the freezers to below normal freezer temperatures. So they store the cold when the wind energy is available. And then when they need the electricity, they simply switch off the freezer, which is now much colder than you would have it normally, and becomes slightly warmer to normal freezer temperatures from the stored coldness. And essentially what you have done is you have stored wind energy as coldness. So there are lots of ingenious ways to get this done. They are available today. You can store it as compressed air. You know, when you go to the garage and the mechanic takes off the tire or puts back the tire on, the little tool that he uses to put the nuts on and take the nuts off and on is run by compressed air.
Right.
That's what you put in your tires, for instance, when you check the air in your tires, it's compressed air. So you can store compressed air in a cavern. You can store compressed air in cylinders. And that's one way to store wind energy. There's a new design of windmill that actually doesn't generate electricity. It, first of all, just has an air compressor behind the wind turbine, and it stores compressed air. And then whenever you need electricity, you use the compressed air to drive a turbine. So one of the reasons I've been in the energy business for 37 years, and I have never before said that renewables and efficiency is very important, will solve the 100% of the energy problem. Exactly because I was not confident that we can deal with the problem of intermittency, not only technically, but economically. But now I am confident that we can do it. And a year after I finished my book, I think we can do it faster than what I anticipated when I did my book. I think we can transform the whole electricity sector probably in 25 or 30 years, not 40 years.
We'd have to start now, and there'd have to be a political movement that really supported that in the face of a whole lot of opposition.
You have an enlightened, you know, electricity, the rest of the energy sector, like fuel for aircraft and industry and so on, is complicated. But electricity can be done at the state level. You don't have to wait for the federal government and some messiah to come along and save us. The electricity is within the purview of the state. You can have a 100% renewable portfolio standard in New Mexico, and you can legislate it and say, we are going to get this done by 2035 or 2040, and here are the intermediate steps, and we're going to do 2.5% every year, and we're going to get there. We're going to get it done. And I think that would be an excellent way to do it. And if there were a fund that did energy efficiency at the same time, I think, and if you can't get your utilities on board, let the state set up a renewable energy and efficiency utility and give some competition to the private sector if they're too lazy to get the job done.
We've got just a couple of moments left, and I don't know if this is a question that you can address, but if we were to achieve zero carbon emissions in 2030, whatever years, would the manifestations of climate change continue? Would they halt? Would they reverse themselves? In other words, would the ice caps refreeze?
You know, nobody has a very good answer to that question. There is a huge inertia, unfortunately, in the system. If we pass the tipping points, and with the Arctic we may have, it will take centuries to recover. But there are other tipping points that we have not reached, for instance, like melting of the Siberian permafrost on a very large scale, although a little bit has already started. And we may be able to prevent those. So where we have not passed the tipping points, there the recovery can happen. Where we pass tipping points, there the recovery may take much longer. So there's, and I don't think anybody really knows. What is sure that if we go on in the way that we go on, that we're doing now, that we will face extremely dire consequences. The other thing is, I think that eventually we probably will be able to technologically remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. It's rather on the expensive side today, but I think we need ways to think about removing greenhouse gases from the atmosphere should it become necessary. And I think we have to prepare ourselves for that. And to some extent, I think some damage is already happening. And those who say we need to help people who are being affected are also right. But in the main, I think we hope that we can avoid the worst effects and mitigate the problems to the point that they're manageable if we get rid of most greenhouse gas emissions and all fossil fuels.
Arjun Makhijani is a nuclear engineer and the author of Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, a Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. He will be giving a talk on Thursday, September 18th from 6 to 8 at the University of New Mexico Law School in Albuquerque, room 2401, sponsored by the New Mexico Environmental Law Center and several other groups. For more information, 989-9022, extension 21. Thank you so much for being with us.
Could I just say you can download my book free if you want from our website, IEER.org, and there are also summaries and other materials if you go there. IEER.org.
IEER.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Pam Houston. She is an award-winning author of short stories, novels, and essays, including Cowboys Are My Weakness, which was the winner of the 1993 Western States Book Award. And she will be at the College of Santa Fe tonight as the first author in the print reading series at 6:30 at the O'Shaughnessy Performance Space. The reading will be followed by a question and answer session. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So I read Cowboys Are My Weakness when it came out in the, I guess it was the early 90s.
Right.
And at the time that I read it, I sort of felt like it was some hybrid between fiction and creative nonfiction, although I might be totally wrong about that.
No, not at all. In fact, really all of my books live in that gray space in between. If I were queen, there would be no such thing as creative nonfiction. It would all be called fiction because invention always occurs, and it's hard to avoid one's own actual experience when one is writing. So for me anyway, all my books have autobiographical elements, although they're called fiction because, you know, I want to be free to invent as well.
So you're from New Jersey originally?
I am.
How did you find yourself in the whole world of cowboys and living in the West?
Well, quite literally, I rode my bicycle out west from New Jersey, and I ran out of money in Grand Lake, Colorado. And
you rode a bicycle from New Jersey to Colorado?
I did.
Good heavens.
And I ran out of money, literally, in Grand Lake, Colorado, and got a job as a flagger on Trail Ridge Road. Stop, slow. And you know...
The rest is history.
Got an apartment, or got a cabin, and fell in love with the whole Rocky Mountain thing, cowboys included.
How do you feel like being from the East Coast informs the way you see the West, or do you feel like you've kind of left it behind?
No, I definitely think so. I think I love the West in a very particular way that a girl from New Jersey loves the West. You know, there are things about New Jersey I love, though not very many. You know, I love the Jersey Shore, and I loved Bruce Springsteen, and I loved a lot of other kind of New Jersey cliches. But coming out here, the Western landscape really, you know, quite literally blew my mind. It opened my mind, and in many ways, it turned me into a writer. It gave me a landscape that allowed me to access sort of my inner landscape in a way. And so I do think that I love the West the way someone from somewhere else loves it. Yeah.
I think for a lot of people, we find our landscape, but it's not necessarily the one we're born into. And sometimes it's just random that we find the place where we feel at home.
Yeah, well, I randomly ran out of money in Grand Lake, Colorado. But But I think that's right. I mean, I think for me, everything about the West feels good to me. If I'm away, if I'm back east, even if I'm in Europe, you know, which I love, or Asia, when I come home and get off the plane in Denver or Albuquerque, which are sort of equidistant from my home in Colorado, you know, my whole body relaxes. It's like as if there's something cellular going on, that this is the place where I feel the most at home and the most comfortable, you know, even though I was 18 before I ever saw the West.
What's your relationship to ranching life at this point in your life?
Well, you know, I have a little ranch that, by Western standards, I have 120 acres, which is nothing, and I really don't ranch. I have three horses on my property, so I've never been a rancher, per se.
Well, for those of us who live on an eighth of an acre, that's pretty heavy duty.
Yeah, well, it's lovely, and, you know, it needs care, but it's at 9,000 feet, which means that even if I wanted to raise cows, I could only raise 6 cows on it. You know, that's the ratio of acreage to animals. So it's really just a gentleman's ranch. It's I have a few horses. I have 3 giant Irish wolfhounds. I have a feral cat, but it's a beautiful, beautiful piece of property, and I'm grateful for it every single day. But it's not a real ranch by anyone's standards.
Now let's talk about the Irish wolfhounds. Being a dog person, I was delighted that dogs figure, and one particular dog named Dante figures as a real character, even mm-hmm. with some first-person narration in your book, Sighthound. Talk about your relationship to dogs and how that came into your writing.
Dogs have always been, you know, very important to me in the way I see the world, and in my idea of faith, in my idea of being a good human. You know, I've always sort of taken lessons from my dogs. Dogs have always been really important to me. I got a dog named Dante accidentally, an Irish wolfhound, which was, I had always had mutts before that, and then I accidentally found myself with this Irish wolfhound who seemed to be, you know, some reincarnation of some higher being. You know, he
like
was
like Dante himself, perhaps?
Well, I don't think the Italian Dante. No, I actually named Dante after Dante Bichette, the Colorado Rockies left fielder, but but no, more of kind of maybe the reincarnation of a, you know, a Buddhist lama or teacher or something. He seemed very wise. Irish wolfhounds in general are very sort of self-contained, self-possessed beings, really all of them. And so I had just a, you know, it was a life-changing experience with this dog. He you know, as much as any other person or animal or experience, taught me how to be in the world. And I wanted to catch that in the novel, capture what a dog can really do in one's life and in a series of lives, which is why in that novel I have multiple narrators, because Dante, the actual Dante, touched so many lives. And I wanted all those first-person voices to narrate their experience of how this dog came into their life and perhaps changed it somewhat.
We're talking to author Pam Houston. What was, I guess that's your first novel. What was the transition like from short story writing to novel writing?
Well, very incremental. I had my second book was another book of short stories, Waltzing the Cat, where the stories had gotten quite a bit longer than the stories in Cowboys Are My Weakness. And when I started writing Sighthound, I really believed that I was writing a collection of short stories. That's why, that's where all those different first-person narrators came from. I thought I would have 12 different narrators telling the story of this dog, basically. And then I ran into a problem with time, and I thought, well, I wanted, for instance, the veterinarian, Dr. Evans, to narrate Dante's death. But I also wanted him early in the book. And so the next thing you knew, I had this collection of short stories with 24 stories with all the narrators speaking twice. And by the time I got to the idea of 36 stories with each narrator speaking 3 times, I thought, oh, you know, this is what they mean when they say novel.
and connected stories.
I backed into it, you know, literally. I said, oh, this must be a novel. But I think I was really afraid. I think the way I write and the way I just take a lot of different pieces from a lot of different places and juggle them without any real sense of an outline or a narrative through line when I begin made me afraid to write something called a novel. I thought maybe I would always be a short story writer because there were that many balls I could juggle. You know, I could juggle 30 pages of balls, but maybe not 300. But with Sighthound, you know, it was a novel long before I even realized it was a novel. And then there was no going back at that point.
What is the role of your editor in, I mean, do you have, the person who publishes your book, I've heard one hears that editors really don't work that much with authors anymore, but
that's
some
not true.
Do.
In my case. My editor is Carol Huck Smith, who's been editing, I would say, for something like 60 years. She's an icon. She's an iconic figure in New York, and she is old school, which means after I think something's done, when I thought Sighthound was done, I don't show it to her till I think it's done. Now I know that it's not really done. But what I'm saying is I get it to a point where I think it's fairly bulletproof. Well, from that point on, we did 7 full revisions.
Heavens.
At Carol's request.
And what kind of things did she say too many characters, cut 3? I mean, that kind of thing?
Yes, that's one of the things she said.
Really?
Yeah. But she, everything from... you know, the fact that half the time I spell gray with an E and half the time I spell it with an A, to something like that, something like this character's unbelievable, get them out, to there's too much time spent in the veterinary clinic, you know, let's get out in the landscape more, to, you know, just very, very excellent line editing. She's an incredible line editor. So it could be anything. It could be anything from throw it away and start over to how I spell the word gray.
So that kind of model must help you, because you're a teacher of creative writing now.
Yes.
Do you use what you learned from her in teaching your students?
Well, what I've learned from her and a lot of other people, I mean, one thing I want to say about Carol, and I, you know, working with her has been one of the most fantastic experiences of my life. She's one of a kind, but she's not always right, you know, either. So there's been a lot of battle. So
what do you do? How do you work those out?
Oh, we fight like cats. We scream at each other.
Not like dogs.
That's right. Not like dogs. Exactly. We fight like cats. No, we have, you know, I mean, every kind of thing you can imagine in any relationship. We've gone for weeks without speaking to each other. We've, you know, spent hours and hours in a hotel room, you know, knocking our heads together. I mean, and, you know, and eventually we work it out. But it's a very intense, very collaborative relationship, which a lot of my friends, you know, my writer friends don't have with their editors, as you said.
So you will be speaking tonight at the first print reading series, which is at 6:30 at the O'Shaughnessy Performance Space in the College of Santa Fe. And will be a question and answer series, a reception, and book signing. And there will be much more in the first print reading series coming up. Pam Houston, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta la vista. Ciao.